this week, we are dead set on talking to Suella Yacoub, star of Evil Dead Burn, all about fighting deadites and using lawn care tools in exciting and innovative ways. All this and the usual movie news, reviews and nonsense on the movie podcast that is, quite frankly, hotter than Timothy Oliphant at a barbecue on Mustafar right now. It is too hot to be working. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. No, I'm not. I'm Helen O'Hara. Welcome to the Empire Podcast.
That really threw me, by the way. I was like, is she?
Am I? Your usual host, your actual Chris Hewitt, is away on an important, let's say, fact-finding mission in the United States. Hopefully an important snack-finding mission as well. It's been absolutely years since I had any weird-flavored Oreos of the kind you can only get there.
That is true.
Yeah, it's been too long. But fear not, because I'm joined by not two, not three, but one colleague of such lethal cunning. It is, of course, the mad titan of movies. It is the Nirvana refusenik that is James Dyer. Hello.
I like to think of myself as a Nirvana truther, really more than anything else.
Incorrect.
I think so. This is weird. This is what we on the Pilot TV podcast, Helen, refer to as a dot nethel.
A dot nethel.
A dot nethel.
Yes.
Just the two of us. Just the two of us.
Wow. Okay. A will and grace, if you will.
It is. It's a will and grace. We're just going to sit here, just the two of us, hanging out. No Chris.
No Chris.
We can take our own time, go off on wild... Let's talk about fancy books for the next 45 minutes. Go on, there's nothing he can do about it. He's not here.
He doesn't have the power to stop us.
Although he is editing this podcast, so he could just cut it out.
He will cut it
out. So you'll have the entry bit, you'll go bangly bang, and then you get the outro music.
And that'll be it.
And that'll be the podcast.
That'll be pretty much it.
Yeah.
I am actually reading a fancy book at the moment.
Are you?
But it's The Odyssey.
Right.
It's the Emily Wilson translation.
Okay.
It's going a lot faster than the Iliad, which was also the Emily Wilson translation.
I see.
And it's a banger. I think somebody, and I'm going to be radical here, stick with me. I think someone should adapt it for the screen.
It'll never work, Helen.
I think it could. I really do.
I'm quite disappointed, though, in you as a person.
Oh, wow.
Because I feel like, if I know you at all, you're the kind of person who would read it in the original ancient Greek. So this whole translation business you're talking about, it's not sitting well with me.
I didn't do classics. I didn't want to do classics. I didn't see the point of doing classics.
Really?
Well,
you
I would quite like to.
Didn't see the point.
That's kind of a lie. I would like to be able to speak Greek and Latin. I would.
Uh-huh.
But I am a little bit wary of the kind of people who study classics to draw with a broad brush.
Oh, I see. So this was a classist kind of protest.
It wasn't really. They didn't have them at my school, so it wasn't an option. But when I got to university and I saw the people who study classics, I was a bit like,
okay, fair enough. Right. Yeah. Remind me what you did at university.
Law.
Law, of course, that was it. I was thinking, what would it be? What's a very Helen thing? Was it literature? It wasn't classic. It could have been history. Is there something deeply pedantic and kind of arcane?
Wow.
But yeah, law, I guess is that.
You're
and
calling
more.
Me pedantic?
Sure, why not?
Wow. Okay, well, this is off to a great start.
I think so.
We are not quite alone. I do want to make clear that we have someone with us in the studio.
We do, in fact.
Yeah. Yes. I just do want to say hello to you. We have our workie this week.
This is true. We are joined by Malcolm. Say hello, Malcolm.
Hello.
You are about to see how the sausage, or rather the podcast, is made.
Sausage and podcast.
Are you afraid?
A little bit.
Good.
Very afraid.
Be afraid.
The attention's on me now.
So yeah. Absolutely. Okay, good.
You are, for your sins, studying journalism. Is this correct?
For all my sins, yeah.
Yeah.
How's that going? Is it just a succession of speakers coming into the classroom and going, don't do it?
Basically, I'm understanding that I have to sell my soul and become a TikTok creator to kind of get any attention.
Much like myself and Helen.
Yeah.
We are massive on the talk.
Have you done any of the dances? Are you going viral?
Oh, nonstop.
All the time.
We're dancing right now.
Yeah, that's it.
People can't tell.
They can't.
Everyone is dancing. Mm. That's exactly what's happening.
Absolutely. Well, good luck to you and apologies for everything that's about to happen as we record.
Just to be clear, and for the benefit of your course, nothing you will see here today can be construed as journalism.
Mm.
So.
Noted.
This is like a what not to do.
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that.
But welcome, and hope you have a fun time this
week. Thank you for having me.
Okay, shall we have a question?
Go for it.
Okay, I got the questions this week from Discord.
Oh, that was brave of you.
I'm down with the kids now. I go on Discord, like the kids do, like they do on TikTok, where I'm huge. I don't have an account. All right, here's a question that you're not allowed to answer with anything that came out last week, James.
Right.
This comes from Vigo, the Sorrow of Moldavia.
Oh, Scourge of Carpathia, Sorrow of Moldavia.
What is the film that you have completely and utterly disagreed with the official Empire star rating for?
Oh, Oh, well, Helen, I mean, look, I'm not the kind of person who would point fingers, who would single someone out, who would, you know, call out an egregious lapse in judgment or an error in critical faculties. And you know what? I could go for the low-hanging fruit here and say the four-star masterpiece that is Molly's Game. And certainly that would definitely be up there. And I can't even pile on Chris for the 5 stars of Attack of the Clones, because in the fog of madness that we were all under at that time, I endorsed it when he did it. And obviously, since then, I've realised it's an egregious error. But I did actually endorse it. And I said, yeah, Chris, give him 5. Go on. And he did. And forever will it be hung around his neck.
It will be on his tombstone.
It will.
Which is unfortunate, really. There have been so many.
I mean, literally last week, Nirvana, the show, the ordeal, the torture. That one, 5 stars. Get the fuck. What are you
correct
like?
Rating?
That's deranged.
You're deranged.
Well, fair.
I mean, yes. I seem to remember Batman and Robin originally getting 3 stars.
Yes, and I know this. Do you know how I know this? Because I wrote into Empire magazine to complain that when the game, David Fincher's The Game, got 2 stars. Where Batman and Robin got 3 stars, I was like, these two things I cannot hold both of these truths to be self-evident in my consciousness.
They are the opposite of self-evidence.
Indeed.
They are unevident.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. I can't do words. Yeah, I think honestly, those are up there. It's not even the ones that should have got 5s or the 5s that should have got 1s. It's stuff like that. It's like Batman and Robin with a 3. Iron Man got a 3. And that still kind of annoys me, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
I don't think Iron Man's a 3.
A lot of it comes down to who reviews these things. Was it? Now, I seem to recall, hopefully this won't trigger you, but I seem to recall a spirited office discussion between you and someone who shall remain nameless. I want to say it was over... which we both gave... And this is brilliant. It's like Schrodinger's review. We gave it simultaneously 1 star and 5 stars.
4 stars, I think.
Was it 1 and 4? Okay.
I think it was 4.
Even so.
I still think it's a good film. I like it a lot.
I have seen it. I mainly just see snatches of imagery. I can't remember that it left me with any kind of meaningful...
It was about love, you know, sort of over, like, centuries and stuff. It was about loss and love and all the rest. It was kind of a good thing, I think.
And a fountain. Yeah. But, I mean, this comes up quite a lot. Really, anytime Ben is in the room, obviously. Opinions do differ. Like, I'm held against the coals, feet against the coals. I know, I'm looking for a metaphor, something about we're held accountable for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, as if we're this monolithic block, like Empire think this, but that is very regularly not the case. And we will bicker and we will argue. And in certain circumstances, one person will have seen the film and they'll write a review, and then the rest of us will just pile on them for getting it wrong. If a bunch of us have seen it, then I guess it does become a bit of a discussion, a debate, and we maybe lean towards the more positive voices if someone's got an interesting take. But not always.
I think it tends... We try to make it something that we can all stand over.
Yeah.
As far as possible. But where there is a difference of opinion, there's a difference of opinion. What are you going to do about it? You know, Dan Jolin honestly thought that Taken was a 1-star film and maintains that view today.
Did. Yes, that's true. He stands by it.
Absolutely.
But it's for the politics. It's not, I think the issue there, and we're going to get into this conversation, I think, when we get into the review section, which is that sometimes reviewing a thing is not as clear cut as, is this a good film or not? And there are other factors that were. For Dan, the politics of Taken fundamentally offended him. And I feel, perhaps unfairly to Dan, but also not, that he was kind of unable to separate his politics from appreciating it as a film in and of itself. Because, not being funny, like, there have been some bad Taken films. The first one is kind of a rollicking good time, I think. You know?
I'm more with you on, like, I had fun with the first one, but equally, I'm very much in agreement with Dan on politics in general. And I think, like... If a film is saying something that you consider to be fundamentally obnoxious, it is not possible for you to enjoy it as a film.
But we all do this, right? Like, so I've reviewed films positively that I don't like, but I appreciate it good. And then there are other things where I'm like, yeah, this film is terrible, but I fucking love it. You know, and I think as critics, sometimes we're forced to put our own taste to a side and just, you know, assess it in its own right. And, you know, I don't know if this will come up later on, Moana, but... You know, there are often other factors, like whether or not, I don't know, an identical film already exists, that weigh into that critical conversation.
That's a different thing from politics to me, a little bit. You know, the sort of the machinations behind the scenes can be a slightly different trigger. But, I, you know, there are films where, like, for reasons of sexism or racism or something like that, you know, it does interfere with just the filminess of it. And I think, you know, it's sometimes worth saying that, apart from anything else, just for a trigger warning for people. You know, I think if we gave a non-caveated thumbs up to some very old films with very obnoxious viewpoints, I think we would be rightly hauled over the coals for it. I think that's part of our response to stuff as critics. And it's even if we say, look, you know, putting that aside for one moment, it's fun. Like me putting aside all the absolutely gratuitous bum shots in the Fast and Furious movies. Like, there is no reason for there to be so many women with their bums out. Like, there just isn't. But, like, I can just sort of lampshade that and go, look, there's a lot of casual sexism in these films, but they're so stupid overall that it's just part of a general aura of stupidity, and I'm just going to let you know that it's there so you can avoid it if you want, but I still had a nice time. And I feel like that's maybe what we should be trying to do, is like try and acknowledge it, let people know so that they can make their own decisions about whether they want to see that or not. Something like Jackass a couple of weeks ago, I laughed my ass off. But there were a lot of asses doing various things that were off in that movie that people might not want to laugh at.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. So, like, we were basically, you know, reviewing that for you, James, going, yeah, so this was funny, but James won't like it. And this was funny, but James won't like it. And also this was really funny, but James definitely won't like that.
Accurate.
Yes. Yeah,
it is true. I think you're right. I think sometimes what a film is doing is so egregious that there's a part of you that's like, you know what, fuck those guys.
Yeah.
And so the Melania film, for example, which by all accounts is just a terrible documentary from top to bottom. But everything about that whole project just stunk to high heaven, like how it was funded, why it was done, you know, everyone involved in it. It was just, it made you want to take a shower, over and above the fact that it was incredibly tedious and just poor filmmaking. So there's a lot, I guess there's a lot going on with something like that.
Yeah, I think that's true. Mm-hmm. And I think there is, particularly now, there is a bit more of a political divide in the States. I mean, we don't come across it so much here because a lot of these films don't really get released here, but there's a certain kind of film that is now being basically made for MAGA types in the US. And it is obviously catering to their interests. And UK distributors have, for the moment, mostly decided nobody really wants this in the UK, at least in cinemas. I think some of them are available online. But, you know, some of those kind of, you know, recent Jim Caviezel films, some of the more faith-based films,
Christian stuff
in the States has not been necessarily released here. And so, yeah, I think it's the kind of stuff you want to let people know the context of when you're going in. This is all a long-winded way to say we make
this shit up as we go along.
We try to balance all these things. We don't always get the balance right, and we don't even agree with each other that we've got the balance right, but we do our best as a group.
There are so many occasions where I have looked at an Empire Review and gone, oh, for fuck's sake, and just been furious about it.
Yes.
But
you don't worry, you always let your colleagues know at that point.
I like to think
how
so.
Furious you are.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for that.
I hope we've answered that question.
I think so. I'll give you a quick other one just to see if this works for you.
Go on, hit me
from,
with it.
From Stig. I don't know if it's the Stig or
it
just
could be the Stig.
A Stig.
Or Stig of the Dump.
Perhaps. If you could be an unseen entity inside a film and have free roam of that film, i.e. go in and out of rooms or places and see what was happening with characters off screen, what would you choose? So you're basically a ghost inhabiting the world of the film. You're not able to
interact. But it's not the set. It's actually, you're in the world.
You're in the world. You can just have a wander and like see stuff.
I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say, but I'm not sure I'd want to be an entity. Middle Earth would be the place I would most like to wander.
Yeah.
But I don't think I'd want to be a spirit. I'd want to be like an elf on a warg or something like that. You know, if you're going to tour.
Elf on a warg?
Sure. If you're going to tour Middle Earth, do it in style, you know, or on a fell beast. Yes. See it from the air.
So you want. So according to the terms of the question, right, we're basically talking about wraiths. So you want to be a wraith on a fell beast. There's a name for those guys, James, and it's not a flattering one.
I see what you're saying. So what I'm saying is I want to be the Witch King of Angmar. That's broadly speaking.
Oh, you've given yourself. I was just going to say General Nazgul, but you've given yourself a promotion.
Although the Nazgul were all men and not elves, so maybe that wouldn't work for me. I think really, if I want to be an elf on a fell beast, really, I mean, we're talking the Dark Lord Sauron, aren't we? I mean, let's be honest.
Well, he only made himself an elf. He wasn't technically an elf.
Yeah, but I think on a technicality, he gets by. He has the pointy ears.
Wow. Well, only temporarily. Wow. I mean, first you were riding a warg, which and an elf, and that would have meant that you were an orc.
Yeah.
And now you want...
Yeah.
Not great, James.
I see what you're saying. I should have gone with an eagle, shouldn't I? That
probably
would have been the quote unquote good way of getting around Middle Earth. But it is, like, Middle Earth would be amazing, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you could validly say just go to New Zealand. That's literally what it looks like, and that would be fair.
But I'm gonna.
Well, you are. Yeah. That's true. That's true. And you're gonna do? Are you gonna ride a warg or a fell beast?
I wasn't planning to do either. I was just going to hit up the giant eagles, to be honest, and get
that's
around
fair.
That way.
That's fair. Yeah, they are available.
I mean, and not leave it to the end of my trip to call them either. Like, I'm going to call them in advance.
Always book in advance.
Yeah, I
think like Jet 2.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Really important. Yeah.
But is there anywhere else that you would go if you couldn't go to Middle Earth? Is there anything else?
I was kind of thinking about this. I mean, you know, we're going to be talking about Moana, and I
make way.
I don't dislike the idea of going to like the Pacific.
Mota Nui.
Yes, but I don't really care about like what the people are doing, you know, in between. Like, it's fine. I mean, They're very nice people. They seem well-meaning, but they're basically just farming. And my interest is limited, if I'm honest. I'm never going to get a cassava farm or a coconut farm off the ground.
You sell yourself short.
In London, am I? Well, I mean, maybe with the heat at the moment, perhaps. So that doesn't really, you know, if under the terms of this question, I'm a wraith just wandering around. Mm. I don't think that's quite the thing. And I worry about anything involving the supernatural, because would the other ghosts see me and then like want to interact? Like, if I go to Pirates of the Caribbean and have a wander in the Caribbean, that could be cool. And they'd be getting up to mischief in between times.
Yeah.
But I don't want to get like bogged down in a conversation with those two idiot comic relief pirates. Do you know what I mean? Like, that would be awful.
Best start believing in ghost stories, Helen.
Yeah.
You're in one.
I'd be in one. That's exactly it. So I think it probably would be another fantasy film. But then what else other fantasy films are really good so far?
I do see what you're saying. Mm. There is a dearth of them. I was hoping there would be more. As we say, because it feels like, you know, the when Peter Jackson did the Lord of the Rings films, he opened the doors, the gates.
Yeah,
to
like
fancy,
Aragorn.
Exactly. Hair flopping, wet everywhere, leathers, damp. Oh, extraordinary. He flung open the doors, much like Aragorn. And
Nobody went through.
The idea was that he made fantasy respectable. Like, it was no longer niche, it was no longer nerdy, it was no longer solely the domain of people who spend their Saturdays in Games Workshop. And, you know, it was okay to like it. But then, other than Game of Thrones, I'm not sure anyone else has really capitalised on that. Our beloved Wheel of Time, cancelled. Cut down in its prime.
R.I.P.
Yeah, it feels like there hasn't really been a lot. Even Dungeons and Dragons: Honor Among Thieves, which is fantastic and hilarious,
amazing,
didn't make enough money. Never came back.
That would actually be a fun one to like wraith around in, though.
That would
be cool.
It would.
Yeah. But this is it. Like, they made Aragorn instead of making, I don't know, magician.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was maybe an own goal. I don't know that they know what they're doing. The most popular book series in the world, by quite some distance, I believe, over the last few years, has been the ACOTARs, the Sarah J. Maas stuff. And nobody seems to pick that up, you know? Although I will say Dungeon Crawler Carl's been picked up, and that would be...
It has. In fact, we haven't talked about it in the Pilot TV podcast, which we absolutely should have done. But yes, Dungeon Crawler Carl has been picked up. Also, Brandon Sanderson's Stormlight Archive is winging its way towards our screens.
Okay, so that could be fun.
Exciting.
That could be fun.
So,
but yeah, I think it is those worlds where you have a bit of like design, so you can just wander around and go, ooh, a nice library. Ooh, like Beauty and the Beast. I could just spend some time in that library. That would be cool. So you want the world itself to be interesting, but ideally you want some interesting characters as well.
Yeah.
So, Westeros wouldn't be terrible as long as you could cover your eyes occasionally.
Yeah, well, because Westeros is certainly a rich mythology and landscape, but it's also not a nice place.
No.
So I'm not sure I'd necessarily want to be in Westeros.
I'd quite like to go to the Dragon Pit, though. If you were a wraith, you'd probably be safe.
You probably need to be a wraith. Otherwise, you would very much get eaten.
Mm.
Cooked and then eaten.
Well, you know, efficient, at least.
Yeah, I suppose that's fair.
Okay, that is enough questions, I think, for now. It's time for movie news, which we definitely haven't come back a day later to record after the main recording, which is why we sound different. It's totally all
we would never
in
do that.
Studio.
That would
we
be
would never do that.
It's not
that would
like,
be crazy.
It's not like it had been Independence Day, there was no news, and the whole news section was less than 10 minutes long. Like, that would be ridiculous.
That would be crazy.
Yeah.
We definitely wouldn't plan to record the news section before a Dune trailer.
No!
That would be insane.
Absolutely not.
Let's get into that. But before we do, let's take a very quick break. Back in a second. Okay, we are back with movie news. And yes, that's me. Hello, Helen. And James.
Hello.
We're together to talk about the fact that the Dune 3 trailer has dropped. Now, you went to an event for this last night. Tell me about that.
There was a big event. It was at the IMAX Waterloo, the great massive one by Waterloo Station. And they sat us down there and we saw the trailer in all its glory on IMAX. And oh my God, it was incredible. And then there was a Q&A with Denis Villeneuve and Timothée Chalamet talking about it. And then they finished it off with what I'm fairly certain was the first 7 minutes of the film. He said it's a very early scene. It feels like the first scene of the film. It's certainly very early on. And it's a scene in which the... Because if anyone's read the books, Paul essentially conquers the galaxy in between Dune and Dune Messiah. Although this is slightly... It's about 12 years in the book. And it's, I think, 2 decades have passed since Dune Part 2 in this one. And this is something only alluded to in the books, where it's the Fremen essentially invading another planet. So think Omaha Beach from Saving Private Ryan, but with Fremen and in space.
Oh my God.
It was very full on. It was very, very full on with like people being mowed down and explosions. I mean, yeah, it was wild.
It does sound pretty amazing. I wish I'd been there. I hear you also got hats.
We did get hats. I have a Dune Part 3 hat. It's never leaving my head.
This is outrageous. I should have really gone. Anyway, but yeah, this is an interesting trailer. We don't see a lot of certain characters, so we don't see almost any Rebecca Ferguson. She might be in one shot, but I couldn't really see that she was front and center anywhere.
I have strong suspicion that she is barely in this film.
Okay.
And I think that would track with, obviously, the narrative of the books.
Yeah, a little bit. And little tiny bit of Anya Taylor-Joy.
We do, yes. And I think there'll be a lot of her in the film, but we don't see much of her in this trailer, although she does look quite striking when we do.
So people may remember from a sort of vision last time, she plays Paul's, at that point, yet-to-be-born sister, Aaliyah. Yeah,
She shot all that in one day. I know this because she was literally in this studio yesterday talking about it. She shot all that in one day, just went out to Namibia, shot it with like 10 people, and that was her whole involvement. And no one else knew she was in the film. Literally, the cast didn't know she was in Dune Part 2 until just before the premiere. So, but she has a much-expanded role in this one.
Yes, because Aaliyah is quite important in the books. But what this seems to suggest is that there is tension in the previously happy relationship between Chani, that's the Zendaya character, and Paul, the Timmy C character. Did they say anything about this in the Q&A? C and Denis V together?
Very good. Do you know what? I was expecting them to address that because I think from the trailer, certainly people who know the source material, that feels like the big change, that she not only feels like she's had a sort of bolstered role in this, but also, and there's a hint of this at the end of Dune Part 2 from the way when he says that he's going to wed Irulan and Chani is a little bit blindsided by that and drops off on a sandworm, understandably. She seems to be being positioned as almost a kind of antagonist in this. Like, she's definitely holding him to account. She's taking him to task at the beginning of this, and it seems like there might be a lot more for that character. It doesn't surprise me because, I mean, as you know, like, Chani is, I would say, done dirty in Dune Messiah. She's not got a big role, and what she does have in it is not, I would say, great for that character. So doing something different with that character for this film, I actually think is quite a smart move.
Yeah, and I think also the fact that she's played by Zendaya means you can't have certain things. In the books, she's strong, but she's also ultimately kind of reduced to wife and mother little bit, because they were of their time. It was written in the 60s. And I feel like it would be a massive disservice to not only Zendaya herself, but like all of us as an audience, if you did that in these films as well. So it makes sense to kind of amp that up. And also just that gives you the chance to get much more into Paul's character and what is important to him personally versus his role as this, you know, emperor, as this leader of a genocide and, you know, terrifying figure in this film, which he is.
He is. And as sort of, and obviously Duncan Idaho is back in this in one form or another, but he, as he says, you know, you've conquered the galaxy, you've destroyed thousands of worlds. So Paul is essentially at this point, let's be honest, kind of a tyrant. And all of this scans because the primary reason, the sort of like the driving force between Frank Herbert writing Dune Messiah is it bothered him that Paul was seen as the hero of Dune, and he never wrote Paul as the hero of Dune. Or not, I mean, he's the protagonist, but he's never a hero, not a classical heroic character. And so Dune Messiah is all about, he's not actually the hero, he's just our lead character. And actually, you should be very wary of following charismatic leaders, because power corrupts and, you know, emperors are, I don't know, not a good thing.
Absolute power does the other thing.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, it seems like Paul is maybe not such a sweet, innocent boy anymore.
That's
and
right.
It's really, really interesting to reunite this Paul with Duncan Idaho. Mm. Because instantly, even in this tiny bit of trailer, just the energy felt very different there. And I'm kind of hyped for that, I got to say.
Yeah, and Duncan, of course, was Paul's sort of swordsmaster, his teacher. And yeah, obviously from this trailer, we see Paul... it looks quite effortlessly outmatches him at swordplay at this point. Like, Paul is on like a whole other level. And I love the interplay between those characters. Now, we can't spoil anything. Like, it's Duncan, but it's not Duncan, but it is Duncan. Like, there's a whole lot going on with Duncan that we don't want to spoil. But I love that character in one form or another is back in this story. And also, Robert Pattinson as Sightail.
Yes, because this is not just Dune Part 3. This is also Zendaya and Robert Pattinson 2026 Part 3. After the drama, after the Odyssey, they are now on opposing sides once again,
yeah.
I would suggest, in Dune.
They are.
Exciting. He looks like a weirdo, as I expect from at least 50% of Robert Pattinson roles. Can you tell us anything about his character?
Sightail is a Tlilaxian face dancer. And that should tell you a lot of what you need to know about that. He's not a goodie, I can tell you that. It's slightly more complicated than that. But he is certainly the architect of all Muad'Dib's pain in this particular film. So,
and we do see that he is trying, at least, to conspire with Irulan, the Florence Pugh character introduced last time. She's freaked out by this. She's like, as soon as you came to see me and decided to start a conspiracy, you've signed both our death warrants. Are you not aware that my on-paper husband has psychic powers, you idiot?
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see how that develops.
I like that idea because, I mean, that's a big part of this story is the fact that Paul has the sight. So he sees things before they happen. Like, he's guided by prophecy. And so he can kind of see the future. So that makes it quite hard to sneak up on him and conspire against him, I would say, which is kind of cool. What else do we see in there? We see a little bit of the Normandy landing sequence in there. We see an ominous sarcophagus levitating, which I have a couple of thoughts as to what or who might be in there. But that's interesting. But just everything about it, obviously we've got a sandworm in there. You can't have a Dune film without a sandworm. Honestly, like watching it on the IMAX.
A couple of babies as
yes,
well, a couple of babies.
Well, very specifically a couple of babies, yes. Mm. And they may or may not become important. I looking at this on the laptop screen as I just did again, it's still great. But seeing it on IMAX... And I said this, well, I was messaging afterwards and I was saying, this is the most excited about a film I have been since, well, let's be honest, the last Dune film. But excited about it because, you know, and we've talked about Denis Villeneuve a lot, but he has this incredibly arty sensibility that he applies to this kind of big, grand sci-fi space opera, world building and sort of essentially blockbuster filmmaking. And there's an abstract quality to his visuals and his imagery and the stuff that he does that just blows my mind. So you've got this great story here, but there's something about the feel of it. It has an otherworldly alien texture beyond the fact that it's sci-fi, just his whole interpretation of it. And it is fucking glorious.
Mm. Yeah, it looks really nice. There's some weird stuff going on. Again, we don't know how much of this is going to be like prophetic vision and how much is actually, you know, on-screen reality, if you like. That's going to be kind of interesting to see. We see Paul with some weird stuff going on his face a couple of times, which people who've read the book will probably know what that means. People who haven't, don't worry about it. It's all good.
Yeah, it's all fine.
It's all fine. But there's, you know, there's interesting visuals once again. This is still maybe the most striking sci-fi, I mean, since Blade Runner?
I mean, I don't think there's anything like this because it blends the kind of spacey, futuristic stuff with almost like classics, old school Grecian sort of like looks like. It looks at both once futuristic and ancient, and those two kind of worlds combine in this incredible texture that he uses. I love it. I don't know if that's come across at any point when I've talked about Dune, but
you should really have mentioned it sometime.
I'm just obsessed with these films. I just don't think there's anything else quite like them. And, you know, and in the trailer, you've got the visuals, you've got the incredible sound effects, you've got, you can hear Timothée Chalamet sort of chanting like Fremen war chants, which get the blood stirring. So, I mean, December really cannot come soon enough.
Every day is Christmas Eve and not just Christmas morning already. You're not getting ahead of yourself in any way, shape or form, right?
No, I would never do that.
Never, ever. I mean, I've been all in on these films like yourself. I'm super, super psyched. I'm really psyched to see Aaliyah. I think that that character, the Anya Taylor-Joy character, is a fascinating one in the books.
Yeah.
I'm interested, like you said, it's 2 decades. Is that something they said in the Q&A? Or because she had a sort of... potential to develop in an unusual way because she had a very unusual, you know, genesis. So, you know, her mother took the sort of psychedelic Fremen drugs when she was pregnant with her, which
the
led
water
to
of life.
There you go, which led to Aaliyah being born with the sort of witchy powers. And in other films, you know, that's led to her being like a freakish, weird little kid.
Yeah.
But it could, I mean, you could hand wave it pretty easily as, oh, she grew up to adulthood in 12 years, it feels like. So is that something that they confirmed exactly? Or
I can't, they didn't, did they mention in the Q&A? They might have done, I can't remember. I certainly read elsewhere. I think Denis Villeneuve has said that it's a 20-year gap. I mean, obviously, Anya Taylor-Joy is not 20. She's older than that. But that's fine. Hand wave, all good.
Yeah.
But you're right. I don't think they need it for that. I think the timeline is largely to accommodate for what he has achieved as emperor between Dune Part 2 and Dune Part 3. Because a lot has happened. And we're going to see a lot of that. So I don't think it's like we're going to start 2 decades on. I think we will see glimpses of what happened. We're going to see the war. We're going to see bits of it. And then the main narrative will pick up 2 decades after Dune Part 2.
Yeah. I do love about this series that you have like these godlike powers and, you know, gigantic spaceships and all of this kind of crazy sci-fi stuff. And all of the battle scenes seem to come down to a bunch of people running at each other.
Yeah.
That's fun. I mean, the fact that we in reality get closer and closer to the Butlerian jihad, which led this civilization to ban computing each day, the fact that we get closer to that, you know, makes those scenes feel more and more real as we go on. So I'm kind of having fun with that.
It is true. Although the Fremen, like certainly when you see the sequence, most of them are carrying firearms rather than just, you know, knives and swords. So it's not quite as much of a sort of melee fight as you would think. There's actually, you know, a bit of machine gun action going on as well.
They're also in big crazy armor they're looking more formidable even than they were before. So that's going to be fun as well.
It was very exciting.
And Javier Bardem gets to see a bunch of water. I'm excited.
He does. Yes, actually, that's, and this is one of the from the footage you saw, the Fremen come out of their little drop ships, which are basically the D-Day landing craft, and it's raining. And they just stare at the sky because they've never seen anything like it. And there's a bit where you see in the trailer of them looking at the sea and they're like, what the fuck is this? Look at all this water. So, yeah.
God bless them. Well done, Fremen. Yeah. Hope you're having fun. Okay. So that is the Dune 3 trailer, which is out now.
Dune!
In summary, too long, didn't listen. Dune!
Yeah, that's it. That's all you need to know.
Okay, so we should probably now return to our previously recorded news section, which, I'll be honest, is short and lacking in news. Don't blame us.
Lacking in Dune.
Lacking in Dune. Blame the 4th of July. Look, there's nothing else happening. But here you go. Back to news. And thank you to Dune 3 for dropping a trailer and giving us something to talk about.
Yeah.
Let's move on to movie news. Things that are current, things that are now, things that are hip. What's happening in the world of movies?
I mean, look, speaking of someone who has absolutely checked news this week to prepare for this podcast and just done like 3 things back to back, I saw, by which I mean I saw the headline, that Ali G is returning to cinemas. Is this true? Can this be true? And that Sacha Baron Cohen has made this in secret.
Yes, apparently that is the case. Like, it is not just happening. It has effectively happened. The recording has already taken place at this point. And he will be, he's finished secretly filming it and it is on its way. And, you know, that's kind of what we know at the moment, really. There have been rumblings and rumors that it was happening, but, you know, nobody really talked about it. He was on tour recently for that that film Ladies First that was on Netflix and was basically saying, no, 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 I don't know what you're talking about, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, apparently it has happened. So we can expect that
at some point. Is this a good thing?
I mean, the Borat second film was pretty funny.
I feel that Ali G has aged less well than Borat.
I mean, that's fair. Yeah.
I mean, unless you abandon the sexual politics of that entire character, I don't know quite how that works.
Maybe it's about reckoning with the sexual politics of that character, you know? Maybe that's how you do it. Maybe you bring in a supporting character as good as they did in subsequent movie film. His daughter, you know, the character.
That was genius.
Maybe you bring in a new person like that. I'm not saying it's her or it's anyone like her or it's a daughter or anything else, but it could be just another person for him to bounce off that has that similar effect. But yeah, I mean, maybe it will be great. Maybe.
I mean, it's possible. I covered the premiere of Ali G in the house. Uh-huh. When he turned up, and I remember Sacha Baron Cohen, he turned up wearing a full kind of ermine cape, like regal gown with a crown, with little marijuana golden rings on, surrounded by scantily clad women who were basically naked except for artfully placed marijuana leaves.
Oh.
And he did the entire interview in character as
Ali G. Of course he did.
Yeah.
Yes, of course he did. That makes total sense. I don't know. It could be great. I didn't expect to love Jackass Forever. I didn't expect to love Borat's subsequent movie film. And they were both very funny, so...
Helen, unexpectedly like a lowbrow advocate. So,
very lowbrow.
Yeah.
Some people would be out there going, that's not unexpected. She yeah, but it's unexpected, at least, news. And that's exciting. The also out and not very exciting this week... in the sense that we don't know much about it. There is a news story that Godzilla Minus One director Takashi Yamazaki is working with Ridley Scott's company, Scott Free, on a new film called New, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, N-U-E.
N-U-E, yeah.
And everything's under wraps. So that's about all I have for you on that.
So film is being made, is what we're
film
saying.
Film is being made.
Okay, well, this is breaking news. I like it.
I wish I had more to tell you. Do you know what I mean? I feel like that's not enough.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It doesn't feel, you know...
exciting, like thrilling. Yeah.
Woodward and Bernstein are not, you know, turning in the graves or concerned.
But they're not dead, for one thing, or at least not both of them.
Well, you know, I think it's their professional graves because their profession, journalism, is dying.
It's dying.
Not because they're terrible journalists.
Right, no.
Journalism is in a terrible state, as evidenced by this podcast.
But you made clear already, this is not journalism.
Well, that's true. In so many ways. Maybe Woodward and Bernstein would say the same thing.
I think they would. Yeah. We can rest assured of that. Anyway, the point is, Yamazaki is making this new film. He's already got Godzilla Minus Zero, which is obviously the sequel to Godzilla Minus One, in the can. That's happening.
I like the fact that they've adhered to proper mathematics and not gone minus two, which would, of course, be... a lower number. They've actually gone for minus, although minus zero isn't a thing.
Minus
zero,
also is upsetting.
Be Godzilla zero, wouldn't
Godzilla
it?
Zero.
Or just Godzilla.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least they're counting up and not down, is what I'm saying.
That's true. But I mean, they did kind of get to the Godzilla part of Godzilla Minus One in Godzilla Minus One. So I do feel like there's, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I'm not going to quibble. It's fine. It's all fine. I'm okay. It's fine. But yes, I'm excited about it, whatever its mathematical structure.
Terminator 2 is back in cinemas, which is exciting.
That is good.
So it's celebrating an anniversary, but also The Prestige is coming back into cinemas because it's his 20th anniversary, I think, at the beginning of next year. So you're going to be able to see Nolan's The Prestige on the big screen.
I watched it again recently.
So did I.
Because I wrote a book, which is coming out next year, called A Christopher Nolan Dictionary.
Helen versus Christopher Nolan.
Not versus. How dare you? As you know, I have never expressed any criticism of Christopher Nolan in my entire life.
Never.
And this book will be no
This is
exception.
A dictionary of Christopher Nolan.
This is a Christopher Nolan dictionary, yes.
What
correct.
Was the letter R?
I don't remember. I wrote it quite a while ago now. I do have to go back in next week and just add in the Odyssey entry. So
oh, really? So I was just blank
behind
at the
curtain there.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just lorem ipso at the moment, and it's going to be hopefully some words about the Odyssey.
Okay, good,
yep,
good, good.
Very
like
excited
him.
About that. R would have been...
Pirates.
Well, that stands with P. Oh, I see. But that begins with A if it's R as in pirates.
Oh, Helen, you're so literal.
Anyway, the point is... there was a point. The Prestige, I watched it again for that book, and it is so dark. Like, I remember it being much more of a caper.
Yeah, it's not a caper.
It's not a
caper. It's not Catch Me If You Can, the prequel. Like, no. It really is. But also, the thing that I took away from it, and I should know this because this is not the only film she's done in, Scarlett Johansson's English accent is fucking brilliant.
Mm, it's
like,
really
good.
But it's a film where none of the women come out well.
I mean,
Christopher Nolan, love him, but up until this point, and I haven't seen The Odyssey yet. Some people have, I have not. But up until this point, his female characters have not all been slam dunks.
No.
And I would respectfully suggest that The Prestige is among those where the female characters are not slam dunks and certainly do not have a slam dunk time. I don't know why I'm using slam dunk, but they do not have a good time of it. And they are very mistreated by the male leads, who, of course, for people who haven't seen it, are Christian Bale and Hugh Jackman. And it's a tale of warring magicians, and they do horrible things to each other, and they both become so obsessed with each other in really unhealthy ways and act out in very violent fashion.
Yeah, like really violent. Like it escalates very quickly.
Yeah, like it really steps up a gear.
Yeah.
But it is good. It's one of his best films for me. I still really like it.
People often cite The Prestige as the best Nolan. It's not for me, but it is very good. For me, it's not on the same plane as Interstellar and obviously Inception, which is my favourite. But it is very good.
I think it's top five, certainly, for me.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
That's fair. But anyway, it's back in cinemas. And then T2, not a film you'd like, of course,
no,
James.
No, I would never knowingly watch
never
Terminator 2, the second greatest sequel ever made.
After Aliens.
Yes.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say
that.
All right, well, so that's news, I guess. Also in news, I mean, there's not really very much this week. We are recording on Wednesday, which probably hasn't helped,
I should say.
So apologies if something shocking and terrifying happens after this. John Goodman is working with Brie Larson in a new film called Skeletons.
Yes, this is J.J. Abrams produced, isn't it?
J.T. Molnar directing. Yes, it is J.J. Abrams produced. Bad Robot, Back in the Game. Also starring Cal Gallner, Willa Fitzgerald, Ione Skye. And it's a modern take on creature horror movies, told from the perspective of a young boy who slowly discovers that his parents are hiding a disturbing secret about his mother.
That seems fair.
So we'll have to see what that is.
Okay. All right, count me intrigued.
All right. Well, barring anything enormous breaking overnight and
which
us asking,
absolutely
adding
will,
things in, that is the underwhelming and a little bit boring news section. I'm really sorry, guys.
Yeah.
I blame reality.
Yeah.
We could just make shit up,
We could make shit up.
Probably shouldn't. That doesn't go well for people. Okay, shall we have a guest?
Let's have a guest. Okay, have we got, Helen?
There's the good news. We have an interesting person as our guest. So Suella Yacoub is the star of the new Sebastian Vanacek movie, Evil Dead Burn.
Which is, of course,
the latest. It is, yes. A literal sick burn. In the Evil Dead franchise. So this sees her play Alice, who finds an already difficult visit to her in-laws interrupted by demonic nastiness in the latest and arguably maybe goriest ? Installment of the franchise begun and still overseen by Chris's beloved possessed ghost. Nah, I said it again. and still overseen by Chris's beloved possessed goat boy. Sam Raimi. So we sent Chris inevitably along yesterday to dodge deadites and talk to her ahead of the film's debut.
So welcome to the Emperor Podcast. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm not too bad. Thank you. It's a hot day outside, so Evil Dead Burn is happening outside for real.
yes. Are we going through another heat wave this week?
Or? Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
okay,
we're addicted to heat waves now. We love them.
Oh, God.
Yeah, we can't get enough of the heat.
No, exactly.
what can you do?
And when you say heat wave, it means AC, and then...
Yeah.
When it means AC, then it means I'm sick. So I'm a little bit sick, if I'm being honest, but I'm happy to be here.
No, it's better to be honest, I think, but you're not going to pass out during the interview. You're going to be okay.
We'll see, you know.
All right.
Let's get surprised.
Is it always worrying when you're doing a film like this and then you get a little bit sick? You're thinking, hang on a second, am I being possessed? Am I a deadite now?
Am I a deadite? Well, no, that's the thing. Am I allowed to spoil?
Not maybe in this one, but I think people know that Alice is the hero
girl
of the film. Yes. So, but that's not spoiled too much.
Not too much. Okay.
Absolutely. But there is a moment. I think we can talk about this. There's a moment in the film where Alice begins to read from the Book of the Dead.
Yeah.
The Necronomicon, and And then she decides not to. She says, fuck that.
Yeah, exactly. Which,
is that what you would do in real life? A spooky book with ancient demonic incantation?
I wouldn't read it at first sight. I mean, yeah. Of course not. But I like the fact that Sebastian, because we watch, of course, all the Evil Dead movie before, and we were like, oh my God, why are you reading that so seriously? Yeah. Come on. So I love the fact that for the first time, there is one character who said, nah, fuck this, come on.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's too late, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's in this movie that there is a lot of comedy that are the perfect ingredients to make the audience and the fans like,
So, yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I'm very glad because I would not read that in real life. I would run a mile. I'd be out the door. But it's good to see that Alice does that too. But so you and Sebastian sat down and watched all of them, every single one from.
Well, he did. No, I did it. I mean, I studied. Okay, I have a very weird connection to horror movies. That means I'm not very familiar because I'm very, very scared easily.
Okay.
So when I met Sebastian for the first time, he talked to me about Evil Dead. Of course, I've heard it before. Mm-hmm. I knew what it was, but I've never watched it. So I started to watch the second one on my home because I heard it's the best one. And it was so hard for me to watch. It was really, really hard. So I was like covering my ears and my eyes and I was like, damn, but I want to, how is it for me? How can I be part of this franchise if I'm not able to watch one? And it's the sweetest thing for my birthday. My best friend, he did to me a special editing, like a special cuts from Evil Dead Rise. So he cuts all the gory, very gory scenes out. And he puts kittens and puppies instead. And he pops in the screen and explains to me what happened so I could understand the tone and the vibe. And so this was my first experience to Evil Dead. But now I've watched the first three of Sam Raimi's, yeah.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. Interesting. So, but you haven't seen all of Evil Dead Rise?
I haven't. No, I've. Well,
you've seen the puppy cuts.
I've seen my puppy cuts.
Yeah.
And it's enough.
Yeah. So where someone is being horribly brutalized by a cheese grater, which is what happens in Evil Dead Rise.
Apparently.
Yeah. You get to see a cute puppy instead.
Yeah, I get to see a cute puppy and my best friend pops in the screen and explains to me what is happening.
This could catch on. I think this is, you know, Evil Dead Burn is also pretty
gory and hardcore.
I mean, Jesus Christ, some of the stuff that happens in this movie. Mm-hmm. So if there were, you know, two cuts, so people can go to see it in cinemas this week. There's the cut for people like me who think that Evil Dead 2 is the greatest movie of all time.
I love it.
There's that.
I agree.
And then other people can go and see the puppy cut, which is also like 20 minutes shorter.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But it's so good. It's such a great chilled Sunday movie that you can watch with your family. Yeah. At least
it's fun. It's fun. It's like not even a PG-13 Evil Dead. It's like
no, PG. It's a PG-3.
Yeah, absolutely. Bring all your family.
Bring
absolutely.
The kids.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great.
But I
yeah,
do.
Evil Dead Burn is definitely, I think, one of the most violent and brutal of all of them.
There
I
is
think.
Stuff that happens in this movie. Like I'm a seasoned horror hound. I love my gore, but there was stuff in this movie I was like, bloody hell, that is intense.
Yeah.
So you know, shooting it on set, shooting that sort of stuff on set, there must be a level of remove then. You know, it must be hard to get caught up. Oh, of course it's not gore because there's a tube and there's a bit of blood and I can see the guy pumping the blood out over there.
Of course. It is of course funnier to work on it on set than to watch it. That's for sure. But I mean, for my character, I mean, it never stops. Alice is going through so much. And this is also what I love about this movie. It's that it never ends, it never stops. And Sebastian, the director, he's telling the audience when they're allowed to breathe or not. This is how you feel when you watch the movie.
Yeah.
But for me, at some point, we shot it for like more than 3 months. And
wow.
I was dead at the end of film. I mean, I was covered in bruises. I was super exhausted. I loved it. Obviously, I loved it so much. I loved the team, I loved the crew. Everyone was amazing. But I was, you know, when you spend like hours, 10 hours per day crying and crawling, covered in mud and blood.
Yep.
At some point, you're brain doesn't know if you're still working or you're just sad. So I went back home. I remember my husband like telling me some jokes and I was just crying for no reason. God. I was, really mentally.
Yeah, because it must be so hard to switch off.
It was hard to switch off, but I enjoyed it. It wasn't a torture. I didn't suffer. It was just, okay, what's happening to me right now?
Yeah.
Am I having fun? Yeah, I think I am, but
How do you get into that mindset? So there are sequences in the movie where Alice is... how should we say this? She's going up against some deadites, and you're absolutely right. There is, she goes through the ringer. She really goes through it. Yeah. And how do you start off? How do you get to that before Sebastian calls action? What's your? Do you have tricks to get into that mindset? Or
no, not much. I feel like we were all. I mean, I'm talking about Hunter and Luciani. Yeah. Hunter, who plays Joseph, and Luciani, who plays Tia. This movie was very technical. Sebastian is cutting his scenes very sharply. I don't know if that makes sense. Mm. So we needed to, like, for example, one scene, we had to do one line, the first line of the scene. He used that lens, that type of lens. So we need to be like crying for that lens. But then he said, and cut. And then he changed the lens for the second line. So and then sometimes we had to wait for 2 hours the time they need to change the light and everything. So we needed to cry and to be focusing like very quick. We needed to be focused very quick and
wow.
It was very hard, but I love that technicality. I'm a very technical actress when I need to.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was not that hard to get into those places. Because also I was surrounded by people that I was that I trust.
Yeah.
I didn't feel judged. I didn't feel so like when Sebastian told me, okay, so you're ready. I know it, you've been waiting for 2 hours, but can you go back to the extreme emotions you were this morning? Like, okay, wait 1 second. And then I go to my corner, I cry, and then I come back.
Wow.
And that was the whole film. Yeah, it wasn't like big scenes where it's like one take and you can go, except for the oneer. We have one big oneer scene that's
indeed
really impressive. But yeah, it was very, we needed to be there when they were ready, when the camera was ready, we needed to be. Yeah, it was intense.
That's wild. Talk to me about that oneer, because I think we can say there's a oneer. It's in one of the trailers, although there's more in the movie. Mm-hmm. And again, you go through it. You're being flung around. People are being flung around in the background, behind you. The timing of it must have been quite interesting, because those are real stunt people being flung around, right?
And it's funny. I just found a picture on my phone because I wanted to put something on socials about that scene. But there is like, I'm the only one. I don't have a stunt for my part, but like Hunter has three of them. There is three of Joseph in that scene.
Yeah.
And there is three of Tandy, right, who plays Susan in that scene.
Yeah.
And also two Edgar, so Errol in that scene. So for me, because it looks like I'm just crawling and people on socials like, oh, come on, get up, bitch, and run. No, I can't. First of all, there is a script I need to respect, okay? And then if I stand up, Deadites can punch me. So I need to stay down. But it was also very, very hard for me because I needed to crawl very low to the ground, because if I'm a bit too high, the camera is going to see like cables on the ceiling. So I'm not allowed to be too high. I need to go at a certain rhythm because I need the stunt to have time to, for example, to prepare their harness or their stunt. So I needed to go at some rhythm, and also I need to be sometimes close to the table but not that close, because sometimes it can be dangerous for myself. Then there is also special effects I need to be aware of that is not on set, but this is going to be on the screen later. So I need to react to something that's not there yet. And then I need to be careful to the other actors, and then I need to be on that corner, and then and also I need to be careful of the DOP, and sometimes I need to do an action in the specific light that Sebastian wanted. So, and I need to act. Sometimes I forgot. I agree. But yeah, it's a scene that it's very, I had like thousands of things to think about in every movement that I made. It was one mistake could fuck that take. Yeah. So yeah, it was quite a challenge.
What take number was it in the end?
So I heard Sebastian tell me yesterday, but I think it's like the take 9th that he took. Oh yeah, but 9 time doing that scene, it's very exhausting.
What are you complaining about?
It was that's very great. Intense. Yeah, that's nailed great. It. We had an eight scene that is in garbage. But but I think I was great in the 8th before, but whatever, he took the 9th.
It's really interesting there what you said about Alice is kind of in that one or she's kind of tucking into herself. She's trying not to be seen. Mm. She's trying not to aggravate the deadites in that. And the movie is about her blossoming. It's about her coming out of that in a way and finding the strength to untuck herself. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you were considering with that?
Yes. Well, thank you for saying that. It's something that we really... we pay attention to that for Alice. For sure, for her, the horror movie starts even before the day that arrives.
Yeah.
So she's like this woman that is grieving, and she's carrying this guilt in her. But she's someone that has, I think, for her past life with her husband, she always tried to protect him, to protect her in-laws as well, to protect everybody. And she's, even at the beginning of the movie, even when the horror starts, she even tried to protect the mother at some point. Yeah. Even the mother tried to kill her as well. She wasn't a monster until she needs to be one for her to survive.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, as I said earlier on, and as listeners of this podcast will know, Evil Dead 2 is legitimately my favorite movie of all time. Yeah. I adore that film. But I would say that it doesn't necessarily have a lot on its mind. It's a movie that's about the visuals. It's about the thrill ride.
Yeah.
And Bruce Campbell, I love him, but Ash doesn't really have a thought in his head.
No.
whereas Alice does. And there's a lot going on here underneath the surface of Evil Dead Burn.
Exactly. I didn't, when he told me, okay, you want to be the final girl for the next Evil Dead? And I was like, okay, but I don't want to be a final girl. Her was just... doing like where she's just a scream queen and just do bad decisions, and she's just one color of emotion. She's just the superhero, and also very sexualized, you know, ended up with a tank top and it covered in blood and with the hair in her face. I'm not interested in that. I want people, of course, to enjoy the film, to have fun, and to, but I also want them to be heartbroken. I'm also here as an actress and as an actress to tell a story.
Yep.
I want them to be moved by her. I want it to be meaningful and necessary.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Job done.
Thank you.
Job done.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so that was Suella Yacoub, and Evil Dead Burn is something we'll be talking about in a minute. There is also, however, in the interview special, an interview with Aulii Carvalho, the original Moana, and a contributor to its new live-action remake. She is, she sings basically on the new song, the Oscar bait at the end of the movie. That's not the name of the song they went with.
Oh, I thought that was the title.
Yeah, I think it, honestly, the Oscar bait at the end of the movie is what many of these songs should be called, but this one I think they went
with. Make way for an Oscar.
Along the way, instead they went with Along the Way. Anyway, so there is an interview with Aulii in the interview special, so you can look that up in your feed. That is going to be there. For now, it is time to get into the reviews section. Now, Harry's here.
Ta-da!
Oh my God, it is Empire's own social media manager, the Tom from MySpace, if you will, of Empire. Look, there is no one working in social media who is a good role model.
I tried to come MySpace? Up... Okay, I'll That's go with a, it.
We have to go back that far to find someone who's not a twat.
I was going to call you like the Mark Zuckerberg of Empire, but like I can't do that because that's not flattering.
The best dancer on TikTok, you know, you could have gone anywhere, you know.
Okay, I mean, yeah, maybe, but they don't have power. You know, you have authority. Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, you're right. See, it all comes back to TikTok. Malcolm is right.
Yeah, God. That's right. It's all about the talk.
All right. Anyway, Harry's here. Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I've just recovered from watching our VIP subscribers watch Evil Dead Burn in 4DX.
Oh, no.
Which was quite the experience. I did not stay for the 4DX, but as everyone came out, they looked like they'd really been through something. So I'm glad we could treat them to that.
4DX, I find, is a lot, arguably too much. And that's for most things. For Evil Dead Burn, I cannot even imagine what that experience is like.
I just think it's kind of like the last thing I want out of a cinema experience. Because I go to the cinema to relax.
Yeah.
Even for like a horror film.
You picked
like
the wrong film.
I did pick the wrong film, but... the idea of being thrown about during a film is not my idea of a fun time.
Hey, I actually quite like 4DX in general. I think it's fun. I think it's stupid, but I think it's fun. Like, because, you know, like, for example, I remember I went to see the Avengers, the first one in, not the first one, but the first Marvel one in 4DX. And there's a bit where, like, Nick Fury shoots somebody. And so you get two quick pops in the back of your back. Now, that's fun. But it doesn't have anything to do with the plot. You're not the person being shot.
So it makes no narrative sense.
It makes no narrative sense. You're meant to be in Nick Fury's shoes. You know, you're not meant to be being hit. So that kind of thing, like, it's not narratively coherent, but I have fun with it. And you get a really good back massage. However, that all said, I cannot think of a film I would want to do that with less than the film we're about to talk about, Evil Dead Burn.
So I should say, I am... in my role this week, a conscientious objector to, you know, cinema, partly on the count of I am a massive wuss. And it was pointed out to me that were I to see Evil Dead Burn, I would die. I would die and or run screaming from the cinema because I just don't have the constitution to deal with it. And I felt this way pretty much about all of this current generation of Evil Dead films. They are just a step above what I can really tolerate from my horrors. So I'm fascinated to hear your experience of sitting through this genuinely upsetting film.
Well, if the last two have been a bit much, I think this one might take the cake, to be honest with you. So I don't know how much enjoyment you get out of this one, but this pretty much Evil Dead Burn that comes to us from Sebastian Vanacek. I apologise if I've butchered that. And this has a sort of light link to the last Evil Dead film, which was Evil Dead Rise. And it follows a family who are reunited by the grisly death of an older brother and who, along with his widow, Alice, played by Suella Jakub, and it comes very quickly apparent there's a lot of aggression and repressed anger in this family as they reunite at their family home. And all it takes is for some deadites to come along to kind of let it all come bubbling to the surface. Mm. If you're not a fan of gore, stay the hell away from this film, because I think even more than the Fede Alvarez one or even Lee Cronin's Evil Dead Rise, I think this is definitely the most violent of all the Evil Dead films we've had in quite a while, even more so than the Raimi ones, to be honest with you. These films just seem to get nastier and nastier. This may be like the nastiest of them all. So if you are coming for that, I would say you're going to have a great time. This one also gets into a lot of stuff around kind of like male violence. Mm. And I think mileage may vary on that in terms of... I don't know about you, Helen, but there are like a few scenes within this that left like a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth, if I'm being completely honest with you. But one thing I will praise the film for is I feel like we've had for five films, you read from the book, you say the insane words from the book and the deadites come after you. And I like that this one tries to do something different.
Yeah.
Mainly, the deadites actually have a bit of agency in this one and they kind of have goals just beyond being like annoying little twats towards all of the people that they are possessing. This gives them real agency. And there's kind of a goal for the whole movie. So both the protagonist, Alice, and them kind of are working towards the same goal within this, which I really enjoyed. It's got some gnarly kills in it, as you'd expect from an Evil Dead
film. Super gnarly.
Yeah, there's some stuff with a pen. I'm just going to say that.
Mightier than the sword.
Yeah, mightier than the sword, definitely in this case. I think the most interesting thing about this one, I'm a big Evil Dead Rise fan, and I think that film marries sort of like the... Raimi zaniness, there's kind of like a kookiness to having like this central deadite who's the mom, and she's kind of just being a bit of a twat to her kids and like kind of like cussing them out for the whole film. You also have kind of a bit of Fede seriousness in that one as well, because it takes itself quite serious and it's pretty grim throughout. I do think that this one, the Deadites are a lot less fun. I think it's a very kind of morbid film and takes itself very seriously. There are a few attempts at humour throughout it, but I think overall the Deadites given a lot less personality in this one overall.
I still get the sense that they're fucking with people. Like, you know, that's still a bit of what they're doing. They're not just trying to kill you, they're trying to make you suffer on the way kind of a thing. But I do think, yeah, this is definitely less funny than even Evil Dead Rise, which is not a funny film. Like, that's a scary film. Again, I'm, like James, a wimp. So you do have to kind of take that into account. And I think this is really leaning into a scary, which is kind of what Vanishek's previous film, Infested, which is a really good sort of scary spider movie, also did. I get it. Like, it's one way you can go. If you've got a comedy horror franchise, if you can either tweak the comedy or tweak the horror, right? And, you know, Raimi famously tweaked the comedy in Medieval Dead or whatever you want to call it. And
Army of Darkness, Army of the Darkness, greatest of all the Evil Dead films.
Well, on behalf of Chris, I'm just going to say you're wrong, but I don't have a strong dog in this fight. But, you know, in Army of Darkness, that was considered, I think, by people at the time and many fans, too comedic and not serious enough. I think the recent ones have gone too serious, maybe, and not comedic enough, and this one is definitely going more in that direction. There are some bits where you're like, ha, that's awful, and it's almost like a laugh of kind of horror in a weird way.
Yeah.
But there's very few just really absurd bits. I think you get the Raimi-ness more from the fact that, like, Vanishek leans into some of Raimi's kind of crazy camera moves and stuff. I'm thinking where it's sweeping over the trees and
also
things like
there's
that.
A bathroom scene where the camera kind of goes up the wall, and I was just like, Sam Raimi would be very proud right now.
Yeah.
I think Rise definitely has a few more moments of, like, out and out, like, even like comedy in terms of there's the scene in the hallway in Rise with, like, the eyeball and stuff, and it's kind of so absurd that it becomes, like, funny. I think this is very devoid of all that. I think a lot of the violence in it is, like, real world violence, and there's a couple of moments, especially in the first act, where I was like, oh, this is definitely like a step up for an Evil Dead film in terms of the violence that's being portrayed. But I think without it being kind of so devoid of humor, I found it a lot harder to stomach than I usually do an Evil Dead film.
Yeah, I think that's part of the mix, isn't it? Like, you can get away with more if you make people laugh afterwards. And I mean, there are some really striking moments in this film. There's a bit where one of the Deadites basically shows how difficult they are to kill, quite frankly. And that was really like, oh my, this really escalated. You know, I'm just miming for Harry so that the other people don't necessarily know. But, you know, that's quite upsetting stuff sometimes. But it's definitely leaning more into the horror than into the comedy, which is interesting, but perhaps not what the really hardcore or less hardcore Evil Dead fans want.
Yeah, I do think this is a leap kind of further into darkness than any of the previous ones have done. However, there is also a sequence in the middle of the film, which kind of has one of the lead characters escalating up the whole of the house, which I just thought was so, like, and you have all these different Deadites, like, popping in and jumping in, and it's just, like, pure fucking chaos. And that was, like, one of the joyful moments for me, being like, this is what I like in an Evil Dead film, because it kind of tiptoes towards being a little bit bonkers. And it's just a really creatively put together sequence. So I loved the middle section of the film a lot.
There's a good bit with the stair lift. Really enjoyed that.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
This one, if you looked askance at your cheese grater after watching Evil Dead Rise, this one will make you dread your dishwasher. So do be warned going in. But we've given this 3 stars. So that is a recommendation if you are stronger of stomach than James Dyer.
Yeah, I mean, that's not hard, but yeah, this is too much of a sick burn for me. I cannot even.
That's fair enough. So 3 stars for Evil Dead Burn. All right, so let's get into our second big film of the week now that Harry has cleared the room. Moana.
Moana.
Make way.
Moana. It's time you knew the village of Motano. So, okay. And herein lies the problem, right? We all know this film so well. Moana, the original, 2016?
I want to say, yeah.
It's been 10 years.
Yep.
2016 is one of the best Disney musicals. I don't think that's controversial to say, because every single song in this is a certified banger. We've all listened to the soundtrack many, many times. We can and will, and you can't stop us, sing these songs until you cry. And so this is another, and I'm going to use heavy air quotes, live action remakes of an animated film.
Yeah.
This one is directed by Thomas Kail, and this is he's a theatrical director, actually. This is his first film.
He's obviously, he's got previous there with Lin-Manuel Miranda, of course.
Indeed he does. He didn't have a lot to do here, because obviously there's not a lot of directing required for what is almost a shot-for-shot remake of the animated film. So just in case you've been living under a rock or you've been stranded on a desert island without a ship as a demigod, as you will do, and haven't seen Moana, this is about Moana, and she lives on the village of Mota Nui, and they never really leave. Her people stay there all the time because that village is all they need. Except it all starts to go a little bit wrong because Maui, who is played by Dwayne Johnson, or voiced by Dwayne Johnson in the original, and he steals the heart of Te Fiti, which is a green stone, let's be honest, and it sets in this sort of cascade of events which essentially leads to plants dying, fish fucking off, and everything just going badly. So Moana sets sail to find Maui and to make him put back the heart of Te Fiti, thereby restoring balance to the force. And they sing a lot. Or the Pacific, yeah. Yes. And they sing a lot along the way. So this is exactly the same story, except in, and again, air quotes, live action. And I say air quotes because it is 90% CGI. It is largely shot on a soundstage. So it's not what you'd call live action. It is, I guess, in many ways, what would happen if you uploaded Moana to an AI and said, make this live action. This is probably what it would produce because it is essentially an identical remake of the first film. And this is what takes us back to our critics' conundrum that we had earlier on. Because taken as a film in isolation, right, I am Maui. I've been living on a desert island for hundreds of years. I've suddenly got a boat. And this is the first film I see. I watch this. It's a banger. This is a 4-star film. The songs are great. The story is fun. The characters are likable. It's a bit mad. I've had a really good time. 4 stars. Loved it. Except if you use that logic, then Gus Van Sant's Psycho is also a masterpiece. You know, Miley Cyrus's cover of Smells Like Teen Spirit is the definitive sort of anthem. Like, you can't take these things in isolation because there are better versions available. And I think this is the problem here, because taken as a film in its own right, there's nothing wrong with it. It is all of those things. It's got good songs. You know, it's although the songs are not as good, because less so, you're welcome to an extent, but I think Jermaine Clement, who returns as Giant Crab Tamatoa, sings his songs shiny, and he sings it, I mean, it's broadly speaking the same, but he puts on a very different performance, which I have to say I thought was a lesser performance as someone who's listened to the soundtrack endlessly. But the songs are still great. But I could never in good conscience say to someone, you've got to watch the 2026 Moana. Because the 2016 Moana is just better. I think the visual style is more compelling. I think it's brighter. It's more colourful. This uses, weirdly, because like you could say that what this is it may not be live action exactly, but I guess it's more photoreal, except a lot of the devices, like the cartoonification of Maui's tattoos, are just exactly the same as they are in the cartoon. So if you were going to turn live action into a cartoon, but you already have a cartoon, other than to make a load of rather cynical cash, the question that we always ask with this is why? Why does this exist? Why does this earn its place? Like, what is any reason why you would watch it? And I think this, more than a great many of these, I don't have an answer for you. Because this feels at once, I mean, it's been 10 years, but Moana feels like a very recent film. So it doesn't feel like it needs
this. We just had the sequel last year.
We've just had the sequel. And this doesn't really add anything at all. And when I watched a trailer of this, and you see, you know, The Rock, who plays Maui again, in that large flowing wig, I worried there would be an element of nightmare fuel to this. Like, it seemed potentially quite upsetting. Watching the film, it's actually not. I think it's fine. I think, Moana in this, who's now played by Catherine Lagaia, she's very good, you know, no notes, absolutely fine. But I found the palette, though, weirdly muted.
Yeah, I think it's one of these films where they have put it into live action and that has made the screen kind of noisier with information, but less beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, it is less attractive looking. And what you were saying about it being shot mostly on sound stages, there's obviously some location work here, but there's also a whole lot of stuff where they're clearly in a tank, and there's a whole lot of stuff where they appear to be on a back lot or on a sound stage, artificially lit. And I mean, I don't understand why, if you were making a quote-unquote live-action version, I feel like increasingly, I was sitting watching this yesterday next to you, James. I was sitting watching this and I was thinking, I feel like we have to bring in a limit on the number of CG-assisted shots if you are going to make a quote-unquote live-action version of a Disney classic. I think there should be a limit. I understand that you still want to have your pet chicken or whatever in there, and that some CG may be required, but there should be a limit of like 500 shots or something for the whole film that you have to stick to, and you're not allowed any other VFX outside that, because it is getting ridiculous. What is the point of this? And I feel the same. I've said this. We keep saying this. What is the point of this? Gus Van Sant's Psycho, we were talking about this yesterday. Gus Van Sant's Psycho was considered a noble failure, or just a failure at the time. Now it's a freaking business model.
Yeah.
I mean, there are nice bits here. Like Catherine Lagaia's performance is very nice. She's a very charming actor. I hope she goes on to great things. I really like The Rock in this. I think he gives a really genuinely good performance. I think they give Maui a little bit more of the backstory and the sort of angst of his position as a demigod and this sort of being caught between two worlds. I thought he genuinely had some real pathos for that character, and he added a little bit to that. That is not enough for an entire movie to exist. A new song over the credits is not enough. And again, I like that it's a duet between the two Moanas and Maui. I think that's a nice idea. It's not enough for this to exist.
It's not a bad song by any stretch, but it's fine. Like, it's quite forgettable. It's not You're Welcome, right? It's none of those. It's not one of the
It's a totally nice song that's fine. Everything is fine. The whole cast is fine. Nobody does a bad job here. I don't even think Thomas Cale does a bad job here.
No, we didn't have much to do.
He directs it well. It's just another freaking version of the same exact film. When we are looking back on Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella as like a high watermark of adaptation that took some risks, I don't understand what we're doing with these. And apart from appeasing Disney shareholders, I don't understand why they keep happening. And I genuinely think they are at this point bad for cinema, because they are training people to not go and see when you make a live action movie. If somebody comes along with a Pete's Dragon or a Cinderella or something that has a modicum of originality to it, nobody's going to go see it. And it's not going to be that film's fault. It's going to be this film's fault. Even if this film makes money, you are killing the golden goose with this shit. And it is pissing me off.
Because it's like a cover version of a song should bring a new interpretation of that song. It should feel different. Yeah? Go acoustic. Go like, change the genre. Do something different with it. Reinterpret the material. And some of these films do that. As you say, this is not even a cover version. It's a fucking remix. Like, it's the same shit. And I think I could not in good conscience, even though I think that, taken in isolation, this is actually a good film. I think I could never in good conscience recommend anyone see this in the cinema, because Moana is on Disney Plus and it's better.
Yeah. And no disrespect to the people involved who have clearly worked really hard on this, but somebody needed to do more and try more and be more ambitious with the story and with the script and try and give it something different, and they haven't done that.
Yeah.
And look, that's why I think John, who wrote the review of this, has given it 2 stars.
2 stars.
Again, you know, it just doesn't have a reason to exist, and it doesn't justify itself while you're watching it. It's totally fine. I did get past the wig, though. I was worried that was going to be the big issue with The Rock's
very
hair.
Wiggy, but you do get used to it.
Yeah, you get used to it. He kind of rocks it, if I'm honest. It's quite sort of Louis the 14th. I was feeling it by the end. I was like, do I need more curls? Like, that's... Anyway, 2 stars then for Moana. There is one more film out this week that I want to mention. It's called Rosebush Pruning.
It is. Now, I was going to watch this, Helen.
Yeah.
And you staged an intervention.
I did.
And you told me, save yourself from hell. I believe how you worded it was, liberate tutta me ex inferis.
That was exactly my tone. Yeah. I'd already watched it, you see, and I didn't think you would like it. And I wasn't sure what was to be gained, if I'm honest. So this comes from director Karim Aynouz. It comes from the writers Marco Bellocchio and Efthymis Philippou. Now, Philippou works a lot with Yorgos Lanthimos. So this is clearly trying to play in a similar sort of dark, twisted, slightly eat the rich kind of an area as the Lanthimos films. Here's the problem. It's not good. It's not good at all. So Again, really good cast, really, really great people involved. So Callum Turner plays one of the sons of this very wealthy family who are from the east coast of the US. They're living just outside Barcelona. He doesn't read, doesn't write as a matter of principle, doesn't drive, just gets lifts everywhere with people, and just really likes fashion, darling, and maybe music, and occasionally records his thoughts on a podcast. So there's a bit of a satire on us there, which is totally fine. And when he goes home one day, he finds that his older brother, Jack, played by Jamie Bell, has got a new girlfriend, Martha, played by Elle Fanning. I really wasn't kidding about this having a good cast. And this kind of knocks everybody in the family like for a loop a little bit, because they all are a little bit obsessed with Jack. So Lucas Gage, who's the, I think, youngest brother, and the sister, Anna, played by Riley Keough, and the father, played by Tracy Letts, who's an older blind man, are all kind of obsessed with Jack, and none of them want Martha around. And they're kind of weird about it. And it turns out that they're weird about everything in really upsetting and disturbing and frankly perverted ways. Where is the mother in all this? She was eaten by wolves a number of years ago.
Of course she was.
I'm not kidding. But flashbacks swiftly reveal that she's played by Pamela Anderson, who actually does really well in the flashbacks. I just hated everyone involved. I hated every character. I hated everything that happened. I hated every revelation that we learned. I hated the way the story went. You know I'm down for eat the rich narratives.
You are.
That's my jam.
If we know one thing about you, Helen.
Yeah. Mm. I think that's great. I'm on the side of the wolves. However, this didn't have anything particularly new or insightful or interesting to say. It was just gross and horrible, and I didn't like it. Even a second of it. All good people, I hope they all go on and do better things than this. We've given it 2, and I think that's over generous.
Wow. A 1-star from Helen.
Hated it.
And all I can say is thank you, Helen, for saving 2 hours of my life.
You are welcome. But yeah.
I believe what you mean to say, Helen, is...
You're welcome. Oh boy, what a time to be alive. Well, so that was the review section for this week. There's very little out next week as well. They're all running scared from something or other.
I can't think what. There's nothing out next week that I can think of.
No huge events, are there?
Nothing big or, you know, nothing anticipated.
No, nothing that's taken a while to get here.
No, nothing.
A thousand years. Anyway, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by our Chris, and also another Chris, only actual Chris Nolan.
Which one is the best Chris?
I think that's...
Yeah, okay, that's fairly obvious.
We're not going to get into that.
Okay.
He apparently has some new film out, and it's been a real odyssey to make.
Never heard of it.
He's going to be here. You can read all about that film in the new issue that's still on sale. Until then, until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again... Harry's already gone, so let's just assume he said goodbye. It's goodbye from James.
Goodbye. Please subscribe to the Pilot TV podcast. Anya Taylor-Joy was in this studio just today talking to us about her new show, Lucky. And we've also got J.K. Simmons on this week's podcast as well, talking about the Westies.
Oh, yeah, I did that.
You did indeed. That's right. It's you. Yeah, it's you talking to J.K. Simmons.
Hey. Oh. Hey, lovely man. And it's goodbye from Malcolm.
Goodbye. Thank you for having me.
Have we put you off journalism / podcasting?
Forever.
Excellent.
I'm going to go on a journey of my own.
An odyssey, you might say.
Hey.
Yeah.
All right, and that is it from me as well. I'm off to get myself a little wig as well. I really think I could rock the Maui look.
Really?
I think so. I feel like it would be a good thing. I think it would be better than Moana live action. So.
Are you going to do a live action remake of this podcast?
What would that look like? Less visual noise.
Slightly more photoreal than we do right now.
Oh, God, that's a terrifying prospect. Nobody needs that.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. I'm off anyway, and that's the main thing. Chris will be back next week, so let's hope he brings snacks. See ya. Bye-bye.